Welcome to Now You Know. I'm Catherine Sussman. Today I'm speaking with Rob Laidlaw, animal advocate, author, and founder of the Canadian-based wildlife protection charity, ZooCheck. Rob, great to talk to you again today, this time on the subject of the exotic pet trade.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
To begin with, can you explain which animals are considered to be exotic pets?
Well, it really depends how you look at them, because when you look at them legislatively compared to what, you know, the common person on the street might think about them compared to what a scientist might think, there is a little bit of a difference in how people would define exotic pets. But generally speaking, for the purposes of my work, at least, we always look at exotic animals as simply non-domesticated exotic animals. So not non-domesticated species. So, you know, all of the companion dogs, companion cats, the pocket pets like gerbils, guinea pigs, those types of creatures, domesticated livestock, and a few other types of animals would be in that category, and everything else that hasn't undergone that lengthy process of domestication would be considered exotic. So that's how we would define exotic. And another term we use sort of interchangeably with exotic is wild. Now, I should say that some people, when they talk about exotic animals, they mean animals that come from out of this country. But for the purposes of what we do, working on legislation and all that, that's not how we define them. We define them simply as non-domesticated animal species.
So the most prevalent exotic pets that we see, to me, when I think of exotic pets, I'm thinking of reptiles, amphibians, birds, large parrots, that sort of thing in people's homes.
Well, I would say that probably the most common exotic pets are fish, both freshwater and saltwater tropical fish. Now, arguably, some of those, you know, the more common ones might qualify as domesticated species, but certainly I would say the vast majority of them probably wouldn't. So you're looking at, for the aquarium trade on a global basis, hundreds of millions of individual animals every year. So numerically, you know, fish would comprise the greatest numbers. And then that would be followed probably by reptiles and amphibians, although I think reptiles might edge amphibians out a little bit in numbers, certainly for the pet trade. And then you're looking at the birds and mammals. So collectively, you're looking at millions and millions of animals every year for the pet trade. And of course, there's other uses for animals that are exotic as well, like canned hunting for larger animals, laboratory research for many of the smaller animals. So there's a whole wide variety of uses of these animals.
Globally, this amounts to millions of animals annually.
This, if you include the fish, you're looking at hundreds of millions of animals, not just millions. So, you know, it still pales in comparison to animals that are in agriculture, which number annually in the tens of billions. But still, you know, hundreds of millions of these animals, many of them extracted from the wild, that is certainly not an inconsequential number.
And that was my next question. Where do these animals come from exactly? Are they bred or are they mostly captured from the wild?
It really depends on what animals you're looking at. Certainly, you know, huge numbers of animals are bred in captivity. There are breeders of many kinds of fish, amphibians. There are reptile breeders, reptile farms. There are people that breed birds, all kinds of mammals. So, you know, there is a thriving industry of captive breeding. Some of those are just small sort of hobby breeders that breed for their own purposes or may sell just a few animals. Others are large commercial enterprises. For example, there are some breeding operations in the United States that breed ball pythons and other snakes for the pet trade, and they may have 50 or 70,000 snakes in their one breeding facility. And then, of course, you've also got people that are importers. So they take animals that are extracted from the wild, from Latin America, from Asia, from Africa. These tend to be the source countries, and they would import these animals that are wild caught for the pet trade or for other purposes. So there's a number of different sources, but generally speaking, for the bulk of them, you're looking at captive breeding or extraction from the wild. And in both categories, you're looking at, in any one of these sectors, large numbers of animals. Just to give you an example, the estimate on the number of reptiles that are extracted from the wild globally for the pet trade alone is supposed to be about 12 million. So you're looking at large numbers of animals coming from the wild and additionally large numbers of animals that are bred in captivity.
So we've basically got a multi-pronged problem when we're looking at exotic pets. So you're looking at the problem of taking these animals from the wild and what that's doing environmentally, but also from an animal welfare point of view, how inappropriate it is to care for these animals as pets?
Yeah, well, actually, there's a whole continuum of issues, but they can generally be divided into some very broad categories. One of them, obviously, that you named is animal welfare, because whether these animals are born in captivity or whether they're caught in the wild from intact wild habitats where they live and have evolved to live, there are huge, huge welfare problems associated with keeping them in even the best circumstances. There's also human health and safety concerns. You know, many of the animals in the exotic pet trade are dangerous in that they have the physical capacity to harm people or kill people. And then as well, there's an additional danger with zoonotic disease. So those are diseases that can be transferred between humans and animals, both ways sometimes. And most of the new emerging infectious diseases over the last number of years have been tied to animals, and many of them to the exotic pet trade. So you've got very serious human health and safety concerns. And then you also mentioned, you know, disruption to natural ecosystems. If you're going in as a collector and you're stripping out all the turtles in a river system, or if you're picking up all the lizards in a particular area of desert, well, you may be removing a key component of that ecosystem and disrupting the functioning of that ecosystem, as well as causing damage, turning over rocks, digging out burrows, and doing all the things that collectors do. And then once the animals are at their destination points, whether it's in Japan or China, the EU, or North America, which tend to be the consumer countries for most of the exotics, then you've also got other dangers in that many animals will be discarded by people, so abandoned just to fend for themselves in local parks or outside of towns and cities. And when people do that, you know, they may be introducing new and novel diseases to animals that are here already that don't have those diseases. And as well, some of these animals will become established and may interfere with the normal functioning of the ecologies in which they've been released into. And a good example of that is if you look at Florida, there's about 65 species of reptiles that have now established themselves. And in fact, I did a bicycle ride up the Florida Keys just a few years ago, and one of those introduced species are green iguanas, and they're all over the Keys in southern Florida. And, you know, when I was riding my bike, I could see them running off the highway because they were frightened. They're just one example. Probably the best example, and it scares most people, are the giant snakes that are now established as a top-tier predator in the Everglades. You know, there are literally thousands of them. You know, nobody really knows what impact over the long term will these snakes have on the functioning of the Everglades and the habitats that surround the Everglades and also in the rest of Florida. You know, probably it's going to be a detrimental impact and a very serious one. And I think that's what most people that study this believe. So, you know, you've got all kinds of dangers with this trade. And then there's some people that say, well, there's a conservation purpose. The pet trade people are, and the private owners are breeding these animals and that's saving them. Well, that's really a lot of nonsense, because when you're breeding animals, it should be done in a very well thought out, scientifically based program that aims to put progeny of the founder population back into the natural environment as soon as possible.
Do you have any idea as to, like, percentage wise, the number of animals that are wild caught compared to bred when it comes to exotics?
It varies, and it's very difficult to track, because let's say we were trying to look at that here in Canada. Well, we tried a few years ago to look at, okay, what's wild caught compared to what's captive bred? Unfortunately, for exotic pets, you know, for a big group in Canada like the reptiles, there's no tracking. So there is no statistical information that's out there that anyone can go to and look and see, okay, what was the source point for this group of animals, or this animal, or that animal, or another group? That information doesn't exist. What we did is we looked at CITES permits, so permits that are issued for the importation of animals from either the United States or direct from other countries. And we looked at about 2,000 permits, and we got a little bit of information about what was coming into the country at the time we looked. But the CITES legislation, and CITES, for anyone who doesn't know, is an international wildlife trade treaty that is meant to protect animals that are threatened by trade. So under that treaty, Canada requires an export permit from countries that are exporting into Canada. So we looked at a lot of these permits as well as other kinds of information. You know, got an idea of some of what's coming in, but unfortunately, huge numbers of animals don't require a CITES permit because they're not threatened by trade and their circumstances are very different. They may be subject in part to other legislation, like if you're importing a turtle, you need an import permit from the Canadian Food Inspection Agency. But when you look across the continuum of species from the exotic mammals down to the invertebrates, you see that the bulk of them are not really covered. They're not tracked at all. So
then I'm assuming there's no tracking in terms of once the animals are in the country, what happens to them? And how often they pass away, how, you know, what their rates of survival are like.
There's certainly in Canada not been any kind of investigative look at that type of thing that I'm aware of, and I'm not aware of much of it occurring elsewhere in the world. There's a couple of papers looking at mortality in reptiles, some of them estimating that 75% or more of reptiles that survive their trip, whether it's from a breeding operation or whether it's from the wild to a retailer and then into somebody's home, 75% of those animals die within the first year. I think the way to look at it when there are not these statistics available is to think about it. If you've got hundreds of thousands or millions of reptiles or other exotic animals coming into Canada every year and they're not going to shelters and we're not hearing anything else about them, but there, you know, every year more and more of these animals are coming in, you know, one would have to assume that they're just dying in people's homes. And I used to collect reptiles and be a tropical fish hobbyist, and I can tell you that mortality was a common thing. I was in touch with all kinds of other people who kept these animals, and there were very high mortality rates. So I think that, you know, most of these animals are coming in and they're not surviving. And, you know, for many of them that do, they may be the unlucky ones, because when you look at the circumstances that many of these animals are kept in, ranging from the invertebrates right up to mammals, it really is a hellish kind of life for these animals to live. So
if you can give us a specific example, so if we take the example of a pet snake, can you walk us through the process of that snake, where it originally would come from, to it ending up in a pet store, to it ending up in a person's home as their pet, and what the conditions might be for that animal once it arrives at somebody's home?
Sure. There's all kinds of snakes that are caught in the wild and brought into the United States, Canada, and these other consumption areas of the world, namely the Orient and the EU. So you may get a snake, let's say it's a desert-dwelling species that is largely nocturnal. When it does come out in the day, it's, you know, it has a set of behaviors that allows it to move and take advantage of cover and all that. It may be, you know, spending the bulk of its time in burrows during the day, and at night, you know, it would be more active when it's cooler, when there are other animals out, it would hunt, it would do things. And it may inhabit a home range of a few acres to possibly hundreds and hundreds of acres. That animal would come into the pet trade, and what the pet trade, both the sort of specialist pet trade to a large extent, and certainly the mass market pet trade does, is they say, buy this snake, it's a really cool animal, it's hypoallergenic, it's easy to keep, and by the way, you can just keep it in an aquarium, a 15 or 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 gallon aquarium behind glass.
Can I just back you up a little bit though?
Sure.
So from that snake being in the wild, who is in charge of going and capturing animals like this, and how are they captured? How are they shipped to our country, for example?
Oh, many of them will be just caught by people who go out. You know, they're contracted to go out, and it may be on a per animal basis. It may be for a period of time to just go out and hand collect these these animals. There are people that go out and look for lizards and snakes that are sunning themselves on the highways. They drive their car along and they stop and they pick them up. You know, they just pick them up by hand. There are other collectors that may use poles, certainly with animals like chameleons and some of the snakes that are arboreal, so they're up in the trees. They'll use poles to nudge them down or knock them off and just pick them up by hand. So it's very labor intensive, a lot of these collection practices.
And then they're not subjected to any kind of testing to make for pathogens or bacteria or anything like that before they're, I guess, crated and shipped to foreign countries?
No, because there's so many potentially pathogenic organisms that not only could be carried by all of these animals, but for some that are a natural part of their flora and fauna that you cannot get rid of, like salmonella in reptiles. It's thought that all reptiles carry that as a natural part of their internal functioning. So you can't get rid of it. But no, if you were to test for everything that might pose a hazard to people, it would be cost prohibitive. And the name of the game is to collect up these animals, put them in bags, crates, whatever, ship them to various parts of the world, and to do it as low a cost as you can. Because if you do things that cost more money, it's going to eat into your profit. It's very much like you see in other areas, like puppy mills. You know, they have, lousy vet care, if any vet care, poor conditions. They're feeding the dogs garbage food. You know, it's all about making the profit. So every time...
Essentially, there's no regulation, and a lot of these animals are probably dying just in transit.
The numbers make it very difficult for enforcement agencies to look at everything that's out there. And, you know, that's not just animals. That's everything in transit. I heard some estimate just recently that, material goods coming into Canada, less than 10% of what's coming in is even examined by anybody in a cursory way. So, the sheer numbers and numbers of people that are involved in enforcement at customs and all of those things just make it impossible to check everything. There are some rules. There's the International Air Transport Association rules for how you transport animals. But again, if they're not being checked, a lot of things can happen. And the standards that are out there certainly are not optimal. They're very basic. But all the evidence suggests that, yes, for many kinds of animals, there's a high mortality in transit because of the conditions, because of the stress. And that's just part of doing business. So, so that snake that's caught in the desert for the pet trade, has to suffer through all of that. It will end up at a supplier that will then send it to a pet store or sell directly to the public online. And, it goes into probably a very well-meaning person's home. They buy this animal. They think it's really cool. They are told that they can handle it properly and provide for it properly, when in fact they can't. And for many of these species, their natural ecologies and life histories have never even been studied in the wild, so nobody really knows what they are. So, people get these animals and they stick them in something like an aquarium that's, completely antithetical to good reptile keeping. You don't want to keep them in an aquarium, and you don't want to give them just one warm spot and one cool spot. You want to provide complex, flexible environments that mimic, at least to a certain degree, the environments that they came from. And realistically, that's impossible for most species. But, that's the kind of thing that these animals suffer through. They're just living their lives, going about their business. Somebody grabs them up, sticks them in a container. They may go to a collector facility in, the country where they're collected, like Madagascar or wherever. They get shipped off by air, usually end up in a foreign country, end up in a pet store, then in the consumer's home. And all the way along, it's just a recipe for disaster from the perspective of animal welfare. And I think that should be enough to make people really rethink this, let alone the arguments that, can be made about how detrimental this whole thing is to human health and safety, to environmental protection. And I think it's also, I haven't mentioned this, but I think it's also very damaging in a conservation sense and in an educative sense as well.
I was going to say even educationally, because an exotic species in somebody's home as a pet, well, that in and of itself seems to be sending the wrong message.
Oh, absolutely. And, if you go to some of the better captive facilities, so some of the better zoos around the world, and other kinds of facilities where the public can go out and look at animals. You know, there's an attempt to do provide some real-world information to provide accommodation for that animal that allows that animal to engage in normal behaviors and all that. For most of the exotic pets, that's just not the case, you know. And the trend is getting worse, because when you look at something like the reptile trade, you see this exponential growth in the use of Tupperware containers and drawers and boxes for keeping these animals, where snakes, you know, sit in a coiled position basically their entire lives, and they can't do anything that they've evolved to do. You know, lizards, the same. And you can even look at mammals. I just saw a few days ago somebody's facility for keeping a kinkajou in their basement, and it was basically a metal cage, more of a glorified bird cage. And when you look at the conditions that so many of these animals are in, you don't need to be a PhD in ethology or have a veterinary degree or be an animal welfare specialist. You can look at it and say, wow, that's pretty brutal. And then if you pick up a book, even a children's book, about what these animals do and how they actually live, it becomes perfectly clear very quickly just how bad the circumstances for these animals are.
What are the worst of the worst in terms of exotics as pets? Are there some exotic species that fare better than others as pets?
When you look at it from the animal's perspective, you see there's no benefit to the animals. It's a completely one-sided relationship. And I think any compassionate thinking person, when they think about that seriously, and they've got an exotic animal, that they should come to the conclusion that maybe what they're doing needs to be reevaluated. Either they have to change how they deal with their animal, or they have to just stop keeping that animal or not acquire more in the future. So don't keep them. There are no easy to keep exotic animals. Anybody who tells you that there are, they're lying. The smallest animals are very difficult to keep. The biggest animals are very difficult to keep. Some of them are easy to keep badly because they're hardy and they won't die. I'll give you an example is tigers. You know, thankfully, not that many people in Canada are keeping tigers as pets anymore. There used to be lots of them. But tigers...
But some people are.
Some people are. But tigers, you know, they range over hundreds, if not thousands, of square kilometers of home range. They, you know, a lot of people know from watching TV some of the things that tigers do and how much space they use and all of that. Well, tigers can thrive for 20 or more years living in a chicken wire cage in someone's backyard where they can barely move. You know, it's so much of what is going on for so many of these animals is just because you can't keep these animals properly in home situations. And just because it's small doesn't mean you can keep it either, because some of the small animals require proportionately greater amounts of space than some of the large animals. So, you know, the longevity of animals is also a consideration, and it's a big consideration for birds. But, you know, it's something that I find rather incredulous, because if you say you care about animals, I think you have to really examine what you're doing, learn about the animals and about how they normally live. And if you find that, hey, I can't provide an environment in which they can do a lot of what they would normally do, where they evolved to live, you know, I think if you can't provide that, and like I said, I don't think you can for nearly all exotics, then you really have to question. In my case, as soon as I started learning this stuff and learning more about the welfare of these animals, I thought, well, if I like animals, this doesn't make any sense to keep them. And I stopped. Now, there are people that have animals now. There are an estimated, I think, 20 to 40 million birds in the United States. They're the, I think, fourth biggest category of pet animals. And there's all kinds of other exotics. And I'm not suggesting that people just take them to the vet and have them euthanized. But I think people have to stop getting more, and you have to learn more and do as good a job as you possibly can to make the lives of the animals that you currently have better. The reality is there's nowhere for them to go. Zoos won't take them. Sanctuaries are full. There's nowhere for most of these animals to go. So just stop buying more. Do the best you can. And, you know, if everybody did that, then over a relatively short period of time, the bulk of the exotic animal population out there would be gone.
Should we also be pressuring our local members of parliament to, you know, change laws, put more laws in place?
Absolutely. Some provinces in Canada, like Prince Edward Island and New Brunswick, they deal with the ownership and importation and all other aspects of these animals on a provincial basis. In other provinces like Ontario, the regulation and control of these animals is largely a function of individual municipalities. So yeah, everybody should be letting their policymakers at whatever level know that this is a concern to them and that their communities should be doing something about it. And I will say that it's very, very encouraging because across the country, things are changing. You know, people that are in those power structures, either in the bureaucratic side of things or the political side of things, they're hearing about these issues, they're understanding them, and a lot of them are taking action. So we're moving in the right direction, but we need more people involved because there are still today, as we sit here talking, animals coming across the border and hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of exotic animals incarcerated in people's homes in conditions that really don't meet their needs.
I was on a field trip, a school trip with my daughter to the Toronto Humane Society last year, actually, and there were just a ton of, the Humane Society was kind of overrun with rabbits and with turtles. So if somebody, would you encourage a person, if somebody is just bent on having an exotic pet, would you encourage them to at least go to a facility like a shelter, or where would you encourage them to get one of these pets if they're set on doing so?
If they're set on doing so, absolutely, I would suggest a shelter or a rescue, but I would qualify that advice by saying that before they go to the shelter or the rescue, they should research very carefully the kind of animal they want, because they won't be doing those animals any favors if they go and acquire that animal and haven't done their research and then, you know, give them improper accommodation and food and they're, you know, an impoverished life behaviorally and all of that. You know, they're not going to do them any favors. So I would say, yeah, definitely don't buy an exotic pet. Go and acquire one from a shelter or a rescue, but make darn sure that you have the knowledge and the financial capacity to look after that animal properly. And the other thing that I would say is do not rely on information on how to take care of these animals from the pet industry, because that is not generally scientifically vetted information, and it's not information that generally would lead to an acceptable level of welfare for these animals. You have to look beyond that, you know, beyond the pet trade industry information. They're interested in convenience husbandry. It tends not to be science-based. And for anyone who really wants to do it properly, you have to look at other sources.
Rob, fascinating as usual. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.